because I went down to see a particular senator in Texas. And he listened to our case, how we wanted a legitimacy law, the Uniform Fraternity Act, and so on. And then he sat back and puffed his cigar, and he said, ladies and gentlemen, all I can say is that everybody in Texas who gets something done has a lobby. And if you want to do something, then you have to organize those bastards. Whenever I am trying to follow two eloquent speakers like this, I am reminded of a story that in the international in the International Peace Corps that three girls were being interviewed, one from England, one from the United States, and one from France, and they were given this hypothetical. You are alone on a desert island, and you see 1,000 Marines coming who will also be shipwrecked with you, and you're the only woman on this island. What would you do? And the American girl said, I would swim to shore. That's the only honorable thing to do. And the English girl said, I would demand to see the commanding officer. And the French girl said, I understand the facts. I understand what ye say, but what is the problem? Well, I'm not here as a Catholic or as a priest, but just a grown-up fetus who was an unwanted child. I have the perfect solution that if the doctors would work a little bit harder, sorry about that, doctor, they would have an injection or a pill or something that a woman would take, and on the day of 24 or 48 hours when she is ovulating and can get pregnant, she'd turn a color, like red. Stop. That would solve the whole thing. You know, isn't that funny? No? Well, I want to discuss this matter with you and the options that are in the law, and to say to you that this is not only a complicated matter, but it is a matter on which, as a Catholic and as a person who understands something of the deep moral and religious convictions of Catholics, Protestants, Jewish people, and secular humanists in this country, I say to you that we can't solve the problem simply by by principles of expediency or pragmatism. There is a fundamental moral issue here. Let me, if I may, therefore, review with you just briefly what Catholics and particularly Protestant theologians and Protestant groups say, and then move into the three options that the law has available to it and ask what are those real gut issues that we should talk about. For better or for worse, the morality of the Catholics, up to this point at least, is relatively clear. And in the Vatican Council, they said categorically that abortion is an unspeakable crime. I think that it is more clear among Protestants than you might imagine. And if I may, let me quote the National Council of Churches. I want to suggest to you that this is by no means, as has been suggested in several states where this is in litigation or under legislation, that this is by no means a Catholic versus a non-Catholic issue. In 1961, the National Council of Churches, which represents virtually all Protestant bodies, said this: Protestant Christians are agreed in condemning abortions or any method which destroys human life, except when the life or health of the mother is at stake. The destruction of life already begun cannot be condoned as a method of family limitations. Similarly, the Episcopalians said this: in the strongest terms, Christians reject the practice of induced abortion. Likewise, the Lutherans and other church groups have said categorically that abortion is immoral, except in the extreme case where the life of the mother, or in some cases the health of the mother, is endangered. Protestant theologians say this too. Listen to Karl Barth, that venerable 83-year-old Swiss theologian. He said this: the unborn child is from the very first a child. It is still developing and has no independent life, but it is a man and not a mere part of the mother's body. He who destroys germinating life kills a man, and thus ventures the monstrous thing of decreeing concerning the life and death of a fellow man, whose life is given to him by God, and therefore, like our own, belongs to God. Similarly, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the heroic Christian who was executed by the Nazis, said this: destruction of the embryo in the mother's womb is a violation of the right to live which God has bestowed upon this nascent life. To raise the question whether we are here concerned already with a human being is merely to confuse the issue. The simple fact is that God certainly intended to create a human being, and that this nascent human life has been deliberately deprived of its life, and that is nothing but murder. I am not saying that all theologians, all church bodies are agreed, but I think, and I could quote Jewish theologians and Jewish bodies and secular humanists who say that our devotion to the sanctity of life cannot be separated from fetal life, because it is not qualitatively different from life after birth. However, does that give us really any clue as to what the law should do in this area? The most sophisticated thing that I have seen was by a group of Catholic Canadian bishops who said this, that from the viewpoint of those who say that this is immoral and that individuals should not morally be permitted to do this in their conscience and by their law, that the civil law should take, from our point of view, the Catholic bishops in Canada said, that we would like to see a law which would minimize the number of fetal deaths. Which type of law will minimize the number of fetal deaths? Before I go into the three options, just let me mention some of the areas of agreement. We all agree, first, that abortion is the last remedy, and that, as Dr. Guttmacher said, it is possible and suggestible only for the non-viable fetus, up to 20 or 24 weeks. We would all agree that publicly supported family counseling clinics are very desirable, and that we would not want, in any case, to have abortion become the birth control of the poor, which, frankly, I think is a distinct possibility. Secondly, it seems to me that all theologians, including Catholic theologians, would say that in cases of rape or incest, the prevention of pregnancy is a moral thing, in fact, a desirable in certain circumstances, and that the prevention of pregnancy is allowable under state law, as I read state law, in some cases, in some states, not all. Catholic theology would allow in the life of the mother when the ectopic pregnancy has occurred, a pregnancy in the tube. Also, when there is a cancer in the uterus, Catholic theology, following the principle of the double effect, would say that the death of the fetus is not intended but allowed, and that the life of the mother may be preferred. We would all say fourthly that there is a right to be born, and that that fetus's right to be born must be carried out unless there is a countervailing right in those who are living. And that is suggested by the law in many ways. What is the role of law in this matter? Until recently, like so many other things, it was thought to be settled. The law that we have came to us from the Parliament of 1803, from which all, incidentally, Roman Catholics were excluded. The fetus has two rights under our law, the right to inherit and the right to compensation for prenatal injuries, if it is born. Although in the latter, compensation for prenatal injuries, the fetus may recover now, at least in one case that I know of, even if it is not born. This doesn't prove very much, really, but the law does, in fact, confer some rights on the fetus. How shall we treat the present situation? Is the present system a tolerable compromise? Or should we have the model penal code? Or third, should we have what I don't call necessarily abortion on request? I call it the withdrawal of all criminal sanctions. Let me go through each of these. What about the present system? Despite what the eloquent people here have said, we have a monumental ignorance about the workings of the present system. It seems to me that we don't have real hard information saying that it has no deterrent value. We have many hypocrisies and stated ideals in the law that don't work. And yet, a lot of people, wise people, say that it is better to keep a stated moral ideal even though it can't be enforced. Prostitution is outlawed, and yet it's almost unenforceable. Similarly, gambling is still illegal and criminal, and yet there's a bookie on every corner, at least in Boston, so I'm told. Similarly, statutory rape is a very severe crime, and in my judgment, much too severe, and yet both of these individuals can be consenting. And yet somehow through chivalry or something or other, we say that that's a crime that should be kept. Well, there's a total disparity between the stated ideal and the order of reality. Maybe that in and of itself is a reason for changing. On the other hand, if you want to deter something and say that we don't want to have widespread abortion, like widespread prostitution or gambling, then you have a law there. And we don't know about the deterrent value. I think that at least the law as it exists now protects life. And we say that at every stage, from the moment of conception until Aunt Minnie is ready to die, we protect life. It's not always enforceable. We recognize that. It's a very, very hard, clandestine, surreptitious thing to get at. Now, you can keep the present law, but if you're going to change the present law, it seems to me that the model penal code has very severe limitations. And I would prefer, if I would have to choose, I would prefer the withdrawal of criminal sanctions rather than the model penal code. Why? Let me just touch on the three features or the so-called liberalizing characteristics. The physical or mental health of the mother would be a reason. Let me spell this out in an example. Suppose that the doctors could predict to a woman that if you have an abortion, you will live to be 72, but if you have this child, you will die at 62. We put that in as a stated value in the law. She may prefer 10 years of her life to the very existence of her child. So there's no question now of the death of the mother. That is a justifying cause for abortion in every state. Should the physical or mental health of the mother be a reason? Do you want that utilitarian, pragmatic cause to be put into the law? That she, selfishly, she, the powerful one who has a voice, can snuff out the life of someone that is powerless or voiceless. That is what it is suggested. The second is the rape, incest, and felonious intercourse. I have very little difficulty with the rape or incest, but felonious intercourse means that a girl under 17 or 18 or 16, whatever the law says, statutory rape, that in those cases, in that case, that is, there is an automatic right. I have great difficulty, and my greatest difficulty, with the eugenic provision, namely that if there is a substantial risk that the child would be born physically or mentally deformed, then this child may be aborted. This says, in effect, does it not, that we have too many ugly Americans, and we would agree with that, but that this fetus has to be just as bright and beautiful as we are if it is to be born. I suggest to you that that is not consistent with the rest of the model penal code in this area, and that I find, is the most objectionable, because it would teach. And the law in America teaches as nowhere else. We should recognize that even though the law is unenforceable to some extent, nonetheless it states a moral ideal, and as in no other country, the law here is central. Other countries have a symbol of their culture or their unity. France has de Gaulle, God help them. England has the royalty. And other countries have an ethnic or cultural or religious or spiritual ideal which is absent in the law, absent in America, and that's why the law is so important. I could go on and suggest other difficulties that I have, and that as both previous speakers have suggested, the model penal code will not solve the real problem, which is the fact that 80% of all of the women who want abortion are married and simply don't want the child. There's no physical or mental health reason, there's no rape or incest, and there is no predictably deformed child. What should we do, because this is the problem? I come to the third option, and I suggest to you that this at least has the merit of not involving the law and society in the business of selecting those persons whose lives may be legally terminated. A system of allowing abortion on request has the undeniable value of neutralizing the law, so that while the law does not forbid abortion, it does not, on the other hand, sanction it. It does not say we don't want retarded children or deformed fetuses, or we prefer the physical or mental health of the mother. The law withdraws and says that we are incapable of regulating this area, and this must lie in the consciences of people and in the ethical practices of doctors. I can find justification for this approach to jurisprudence in many things. I think that, let me quote Father John Cody Murray in his volume, We Hold These Truths. He writes there, the aspirations of law are minimal. Law seeks to establish and maintain only that minimum actualized morality that is necessary for the healthy functioning of the social order. Law enforces only what is minimally acceptable, and in this sense, socially necessary. Therefore, the law, mindful of its nature, is required to be tolerant of many evils that morality condemns. And that approach to jurisprudence would be mine, and I think it would clearly condemn laws totally unenforceable, which exist in some half of the states against adultery and fornication. As far as I know, those things are still morally condemned by some churches, at least my church, but I think that there is no justification for a law which would forbid adultery and fornication, because I know of no one who has gone to prison recently or within living memory for that type of a crime. Can you spread this and say that this is the best approach to the whole question of regulating abortion? At least you could say that the adoption of such a non-law doesn't escalate or increase the number of legally unauthorized abortions. The adoption of the Model Penal Code will teach, and it will teach that abortion under some circumstances is permitted, and apparently people will get the idea that it's allowable, and therefore, as in Scandinavia, the number of illegal abortions will escalate. If we therefore say that the American Law Institute will lead almost inevitably to a de facto authorization of abortion on request, then let's be honest about the thing and say that the law is bankrupt in this area, the law can't regulate, and that we ought to treat women who want an abortion as civilized human beings and do what we can for them. Now, I'm not exactly advocating this because of the monumental ignorance. And if we had more facts about this whole problem, which is so clandestine, to repeat, then I would say that this seems to me a much more promising solution than the Model Penal Code. I suggest to you that this law, which is silent about the abortion of non-viable fetuses, says nothing invidious. It doesn't discriminate between those who are born and those who are unborn. And it doesn't say that just because we can't see them, they're not living. It just says this is a social problem for which the law has no regulation in its criminal sanctions. And I suggest to you that this has enormous potential. Why should we take a woman, 80% of them married, and turn her into a criminal because her system of family planning has failed? Under the system of no criminal sanctions, at least we could smoke out the illegal abortionist, and that any non-doctor doing an abortion could be put in jail just like we'd put a non-doctor doing brain surgery in jail. This would be a very severe crime. At least we could smoke out the illegal operations. A woman would have to go to a doctor, and there, or with others, she would get counseling, and at least she wouldn't have to hopefully go through this agonizing trauma of another abortion. Doesn't this offer a better possible solution than the Model Penal Code? I suggest to you that it does. However, I'm not saying that that's going to be the panacea. It has at least the one benefit, the long-range good effect, is that it keeps the state out of the business of decreeing who is to be born and who can be abolished. And it, in all candor, keeps more hypocrisies out of the law. We have too many hypocrisies. And if I may mention one, perhaps a bit indelicate, but some states allow the sale of contraceptives for the prevention of disease, and that's a lie. That's not true. It can't prevent disease. And I suggest to you that before we put more lies into the law, we should say, what is the problem, and get down to the problem and solve it. And it's a social problem. It's not a medical problem. I feel badly in handing this social problem over to the doctors. They don't like to do abortions except when medical reasons are indicated. And let's face it, it's a very serious social problem. At least 200,000 women each year, perhaps 1 million each year. And I suggest to you that if we're going to solve it, then we should say we must get facts, we must hammer out solutions, but nonetheless there is a moral norm involved. And let me come now to my fourth and final point. What should the churches and those who believe that a fetus is just as much a human being as an infant? What is the extent of the limits of the persuasion, if you will, that they must utilize? I think that the churches should not be silent on this issue. They shouldn't say that just as the liberals cheered the Catholic bishops in the South when they denounced segregation and integrated segregated schools. I think that the people should speak out, and that we should welcome their speaking out, even though we might disagree with them. How far should they go? To what is the extent of the moral persuasion of the churches? I predict that there will be stormy intercreedal tensions ahead, and particularly those Catholics are going to make a lot of noises. And I'm not faulting them for that, because the Catholics have been accused of silence long enough, and rightly enough. And at this moment in history, when Catholics feel, God help us, a sense of security in America, they are beginning to say that we have an obligation towards the legal institutions of this country. I was very proud that 15 Catholic bishops signed a statement, an amicus curiae brief, in the miscegenation case. And when the National Conference of Catholic Interracial Councils filed a very good brief in that case. And it seems to me that we can't have it both ways. We can't say that it's good for them to speak out when we agree, but not when the tide seems to be going the other way. How firm and strong should they be? There is more Protestant feeling on this, as I mentioned, but that is on the morality of the thing. But whose moral norm should we follow? Clearly, the Catholic Church has the right and the duty, I suppose, to speak out for its own communicants. What should it say to the legislators of America? I would say that after stating the moral norms, no Catholic body, official or otherwise, should take any position on the jurisprudence of this thing. And the right approach, as I see it, is the Canadian Catholic Bishop's approach, that this is a very complex jurisprudential, social, and moral problem, and that the legislators have to decide what system is best. On the other hand, the Catholics and everyone else should say that there is a right and a duty to speak out, and that even though it's going to be very difficult, the Catholics, shall we say, must at a moment in time use Catholic persuasion, not as Catholic power, but as the honest, sincere opinion of people who operate from premises and presuppositions and who feel that the present law was a law put in by individuals who in their consciences felt that society should protect all law, and that simply because a fetus is unseen and its appearance is going to be very inconvenient, we should not operate on the pragmatic and utilitarian thesis that we can wipe out all fetuses whose existence will be inconvenient to us. That is a fair presentation of the law as it has existed up to now. If we do legalize abortion, the Catholic position, those who believe that abortion is wrong, just as infanticide would be wrong, and everyone admits that that is unthinkable, that their principles will remain the same. But nonetheless, everyone has a right and a duty to shape the moral contours of society, especially in a matter so fundamental and so basic as this. I say to you that the essence of the whole moral problem, as I see it, is this, that the integrity, the untouchableness, the inviolability of every human life by any other human being has been the centerpiece and the cornerstone of the legal institutions of the English-speaking world. If we want to withdraw that protection now from the non-viable fetus, that small potential human being, call it what you will, then we should know what we're doing, and that we're doing it for our own benefit. We're not doing it for the benefit of the fetus. We can say it'll be unwanted and that it'll be unloved, but nonetheless, that it'll be retarded. But nonetheless, we are dictating the conditions of existence for that individual. And it seems to me this inescapable moral issue in this emerging struggle over the wisdom and fairness of abortion laws deserves to be discussed and dissected and eventually resolved. But I suggest to you that if America operates on principles of sentiment and emotion, and certainly there was a lot of that running here, even in this group this evening, if we operate on sentiment, utilitarianism, and expediency, then we damage ourselves. We should try to reach the basic, fundamental ethical issue involved, and that, as I see it, is the immorality of allowing the destruction of any innocent human being carried out by other human beings who are more powerful, who can do this for their own benefit, convenience, and utility. Thank you very much.
The panel is now willing to entertain questions from the audience. Those of you who would like to ask questions, would you please come to the microphone here, give your name, and ask your question.
My name is Greg Harrison, first-year law student here at Harvard. My question is first addressed to Reverend Reinen, and perhaps Dr. Guttmacher would like to comment on it. I didn't gather from all you had to say, Reverend Reinen, exactly what your position would be on contraception, and you'll see how this is related to my question. Are you totally against contraception aside from the rhythm method?
No one is totally against contraception.
Well, I'm asking you particularly, are you against other forms of
contraception? Well, how does this tie into the question here?
The question ties in, assuming medical science comes up with a morning after birth pill, or for that matter, a 2 week after birth pill, is this then contraception or abortion?
That will depend upon the medicine involved. And that if this is the destruction of a zygote, of a sperm and an ovum that have been fertilized, and which by scientific methods is a potential human being with the genetic package, with the blueprint and the machinery to produce a human being, it seems to me that that would be abortion rather than birth control.
In other words, then you would be against the use of a morning after pill, so to speak, under the name of contraception.
Well, this is morality. Now, the legality, clearly there.
Strictly talking about morality now, your own
yes.
ethical position.
Yes.
You would. Okay, now, that leads directly... That's fine. That leads directly into my second point.
I was given, as moderator, the following instructions. Questions, not speeches. Nobody told me about interrogation.
I don't mean to be giving the Reverend the third degree. I wanted to lead into this because I felt it was very pertinent. The second question is this. The law tries to steer clear of telling people what they can and what they cannot believe, religious beliefs. We don't because one group has a belief that it is sinful to drink or because it is sinful, you know, quote-unquote, sinful to do certain things. The law then doesn't take it upon itself to legislate against doing this. If that's the person's religious belief, then they can refrain from doing it on their own because this is what they believe. Perhaps they believe they'll be punished thereafter. My point is this. If you think it is immoral for a fetus to be aborted because you believe this is a life, I contend that is this not your own belief, and therefore why should the law have anything to do with this whatsoever?
That's what I said in my third point, sir.
But
you're arguing my case for the withdrawal of criminal sanctions.
I'm all for that, but you then ended your speech on the note that you were opposed to the morality, you were opposed on a moral
basis. Am I supposed to acquiesce in something that I think is immoral? Am I supposed to advance this cause?
No, certainly not.
I'm weighing the three options as a jurist, and nobody here can predict which option will really bring about the better common good. And no one can. We just don't have enough information, that's all. And I say right. that we have to weigh these three. The present compromise, the model penal code, I clearly am against, particularly the eugenic one, and I said that the withdrawal has the greatest possibility and the potential.
Thank you. My name is Bob Blazer, first-year law student. Father Dryan, if the church and if society sincerely believes that a fetus is a living being, then why doesn't the church or society conduct funeral services in the case of a miscarriage?
The Catholic Church does not have any funeral service until the child is at least 7, 8, until the child, you know. The assumption is that no one is culpable for his immorality or sin until that time, and that there is no funeral service for anyone under 7 or 8. So, any other questions?
I have a question for Dr. Guttmacher. My name is Joyce Massell. Dr. Guttmacher, I am a student at a women's college, and I was born while my mother was attending college also. And I'm glad I'm here. I kind of wonder whether or not you said I believe that you would give abortions to girls who are in college so that they could continue their studies. Now, in college today, we are informed of methods of contraception and along these areas. And I think that, you know, responsibility, which is what they're trying to teach us in college, I think, should be, not limited just to academic responsibility, but personal responsibility, what you're going to do. And I think that if a girl decides that she is going to, you know, assume these responsibilities, that I want to see why you justify giving her an abortion, or why you feel a college girl who is fully aware of contraception as it exists today should have a legal abortion.
First of all, contraception is not always effective. It can fail. And I think that is certainly one good reason. A second reason seems to me is that if the woman uses bad judgment on occasion, I don't see any particular reason to punish her for it. Seems to me that one has to look at the overall, what is the greatest good? And to me, the greatest good is allowing this young woman to complete her education. Now, if she can take a year out of education and not penalize her future, then I think that's a perfectly logical thing to do. If she's capable of doing it, I think from her point of view, it would be a far better solution. But I certainly have been faced very often by young girls whose college... action to the child would be very different under these two conditions. I'm so anxious that we lay emphasis on what I think is the quality rather than quantity. That seems to me that I'm trying to give every child and every parent the best possible break toward happiness with each other. And this, to me, is a very important goal. And if a young woman has to interrupt or call off her education because of this, it seems to me we're not accomplishing the goal of the greatest possible adjustment between mother and child. That's all. Perhaps I didn't make myself clear.
Dr. Guttenmacher, I think that you're looking at it so objectively. You know, when
I'm trying
a woman
to look at it objectively.
I don't think you're looking at it the way a woman does. When a woman, I think, becomes pregnant, you still feel that she's going to feel this great hostility through 9 months, and when the baby's born, she's going to hate it because she has to take a year off from college. And I just want to, you know, give the feminine viewpoint, you know, you're not girls, that I think you're
overstating. I'm sure you're speaking for a large proportion of women, but certainly you're not speaking for all women.
Well, yeah, true.
Okay. I think we've kind of exhausted this topic. Let's go on to something else.
We have the next question.
Thank you very much.
My name is Gerald Lang. I'm a second-year law student here at Harvard, and my question is for Mr. Blumenthal. Mr. Blumenthal, to say the least, I was unconvinced by the analogy you drew between the revised penal statutes and the abortion of the innocent fetus. Now, every example illustrating the point you gave to us, I think, involved a situation where there really was, in a sense, a kind of fault on the part of the person against whom one could use deadly force. I suggest to you that the real analogous situation is a situation where your life is in danger. It's threatened by exigent circumstances, and the question then arises whether you could, in order to save your life, kill someone else who was completely innocent in every single way. Now, as a matter of legal precedent, two cases I just cite to you and then explain very briefly are the Holmes case and the SS Eliza case. Now, these are two shipwreck cases, and they happen to be very famous, and they are there. And these cases, Mr. Blumenthal said, where sailors and other members of lifeboats threw other people overboard deliberately, tried to make reasoned choices, those men were guilty of murder. And the rationale of the decision was that there were two courses of conduct open, of course. That is, one could take the chance that one would lose one's own life, or you could deliberately take the life of another person. But to borrow a phrase from Father Drinan, I think the court believed that civilization's dedication to the divine sanctity of life took precedence there, and one had to incur the risk to one's own life rather than taking the life of the completely innocent party. So now I think we return here, rather than to an argument of legal precedent, to the reasoning of your decision. And how do you answer that argument there? Do you still believe that one has the right to take the life of a completely innocent fetus?
You remind me a little bit of Father Drinan, who likes very much to place things in the absolute alternative. I remember as a child when my sister got involved in a terrible argument with a little girlfriend of hers over a doll. And both children were convinced that the doll belonged to each of them. I'll never forget it. My grandfather is what we call a Talmudic scholar. And he had a capacity for arriving at justice that I found unequaled as a child. And when he found that he couldn't resolve the argument between the girls, He took a knife and he sliced the doll right down the middle and gave each one half. Now, Father Drynan poses the problem by saying that he's morally opposed to abortion, I think probably on any grounds, although he makes a few exceptions sometimes. And then he says, but on the other hand, he thinks the solution for the problem is for the law to withdraw, because that won't require a moral judgment by the law. And of course he realizes, I'm sure, when he makes both of those statements in good faith, that he poses two completely unavailable alternatives. The legislature is not going to repeal the entire law, and the legislature is not going to impose an enforceable ban. So now let's go to your case. Again, posing entirely unrealistic alternatives, not applicable here. You're a second year law student?
Yes.
Have you had your penal law course yet?
Yes.
And you're familiar with culpability and mental disease and so forth. And you are familiar that a mentally ill person, for whatever your law is in Massachusetts, is not at all culpable, not even knowing. Are you not?
Well, they function under the McNaughton rules here, yes.
Well, whatever the rule is, assuming they qualify, they are in all respects non-culpable. And if I had to use an extreme example in order to fit within the tight framework you're going to give me to function in, I suppose I could rely on that one. But I don't think that's really what we're talking about. And the issue is not two men in a boat. And the two men in the boat case is one of those tough cases that make for bad law. And I'm sure there are many abortion cases that make for bad law. What we're trying to do, and I think that ought to be very clear to you, is to take an inflexible, bad law and try to resolve a very difficult problem. The part of the approach that Father Drynan takes that makes great sense is that the law can't do some things. It can't do it. I don't know of a suicide who's been prosecuted. Now, I have a very stern set of personal standards, which I violate sometimes. But my set of personal standards is clearly not applicable to you, because we don't even agree on the law here. But the law is an inappropriate place to apply these standards. Don't use the two men in a boat case and second-year torts. And by the way, I'd like to use another illustration while I got you. You know, it depends on how you say things. Father Drynan puts it, and I think I wrote it down when he talks about the law of estates. The fetus has a right to inherit, and then he hurries on and says, if it's born, very softly. When I quote that rule, I quote it a little differently. I say the fetus has no right to inherit at all unless and until it is born. I go back to what I started to say. The law is many things depending on the circumstances, and two men in a boat is no more applicable to the woman in the back room abortionist's office than a lot of other rules of law that we could cite back and forth.
The only thing I'd like to say to that is, firstly, about this argument about whether the fetus can inherit. I don't think laws like this turn upon really attenuated subtleties like that. Secondly, I think the reason we quote the extreme cases when we talk about the problem is that in the obvious case where the mother's life is threatened, she's dying, no one questions, I think, that abortion is okay. It's in the extreme cases when we want to draw a line. It's in those really difficult cases that the problem arises. And then Father Drynan's solution comes in, and he says the law should withdraw. But you, I believe, are supporting the kind of... are you supporting the model penal institute code to be enacted in New York?
I'm supporting a variation on the model penal code.
That is really different, in a sense, than Father Drynan suggesting that the law withdraw from the area, is it not?
Well, it's only different in the sense that Father Drynan hasn't come before the state legislature to tell the legislators who are opposing any change to the law that's what they ought to do.
Would you support, well then, one final question. Would you rather support his suggestion than yours?
Just one second. Father Drynan would like to...
I have a question for Mr. Blumenthal that, as I understood... as I understood his presentation, he is suggesting that we certainly should have the same right to take prenatal life as we do to take life after birth. And then he quotes the example of the escaping felon who, in his review of New York law, may be shot. And he quotes, the farmer can kill the person who is about to burn his barn. Well, the same American Law Institute model penal code that Mr. Blumenthal cites with such esteem says that the escaping felon should not be killed, and that's one of the rules that they bear down on. They say that's
Father,
an error, and
Father,
that's one of the things I supported as a member of the ALI.
Father, you're misquoting, first of
well,
all. You're, first of all,
you
are misquoting me. I did not say that either under the old or New York or new law that somebody ought to have the right to shoot the escaping felon. What I did say...
Can shoot the assailant.
What I did say is that the use of deadly force can be met with it, but even under our revised law by the Model Penal Code, one of the exceptions maintained is that destruction of property by arson is an excuse, is a justifiable reason for killing.
Well, that's wrong. It's basically wrong.
Well,
and you can't take something that's wrong there and use it as an argument for your case.
No, just one of the absurdities in law that we seem to justify, and nobody pays too much attention to, but when women talk about defending themselves, or men for that matter under other circumstances, then all of a sudden this distinction given about the vast importance to prenatal life and so little honor given to postnatal life, this is the reason why I make these analogies. Not because they're all 0.4 examples, obviously they're not. And obviously it's not because I support some of the stupidities in the New York revised penal law. But I'm just amazed at the things which bring up the debate.
My name is Neil Jokelson. I'm a third-year student. Father Drinan, it seems to me that everybody on the panel agrees that the abortion laws in the United States are flagrantly violated. Yet it also seems to me that the abortion laws do have some deterrent effect, whatever they may be. If, for example, there are 1 million abortions, perhaps 2 million are contemplated and only 1 million have gone through. Now, if that is the case, and if you believe that a fetus is as much a human being as any other human being, say, sitting in this room, then what you are saying is that the law, which is capable of stopping murder, should be thrown away, and that murder should be optional with the mother. And it does not seem to me to be a wise solution, taking the premises I understand you believe it to be.
All right, fine. Well, if you say, if this is a deterrent effect, then we have a monumental ignorance about that. And I was going to say that I would stick with your proposition until we have more information. After all, we have enough problems. We have Vietnam, and we have poverty, and now we have general... You know who I mean, Hershey. And I would say that you are right, except there's a big if. Is there any real information that in this area 2 million abortions would occur absent a law where only 1 million? It's like, as I mentioned, prostitution and gambling. We presume, but do we really know?
Well...
All right, I'm not advocating the change, sir, and you state my position well.
It doesn't seem to me that if you throw the law away, there will be less abortions. That just logically doesn't follow. And then we're talking about, well, does the law prevent any abortion? And it seems to me it has to, whether it be one or a million or whatever the number may be.
All right, sir, but nonetheless, there's this agonizing problem of these women who are in this situation, let's say 500,000 each year, who want an abortion and are desperate for it. What is the solution to that social problem? Now, I'm not saying that the repeal of the law is going to automatically solve that social problem, but would it aggravate it? It might.
Well, it seems to me that the interests of the 1 million women who want the abortion, if you believe that the fetus has a soul, is less than the interest that the fetus may have. And then what you're saying to one group of people is, well, although your interest is less than life, you can take the life of somebody else to further your particular interest.
All right, but there's a lot of implications in the withdrawal of criminal sanctions. You recall that I said that this is the certain way by which we can get this into medical channels. And doctors are not going to do abortions on a widespread scale for social reasons. And if the law then breaks down and can't enforce this thing...
Well, excuse me.
Yes.
You don't know that. You don't know what doctors would do. You don't know if there are doctors who would be willing to abort at will, if the fee was right, or if they felt a moral obligation, as Dr. Guttmacher does. You don't know.
All right. Well, we're saying the same thing.
I don't think so.
Well, yes, we are. We're saying the same thing that I don't know, and I have said that, that's all. All I say is that the third option gives much more potential hope for solving the social problem than the model penal code, which I think is an abomination, which won't solve any of the problems.
Well, at least the model penal code will go to deter those majority of women who would prefer not to have a child with no life or health danger.
It will deter them. It will lead to the de facto authorization of abortion, because people will say it's the mental health, or girls will say it's statutory rape.
Well, query.
Well, all right. Well, it's a big conundrum.
Perhaps this will be the last question.
My name is...
The second last question.
My name is Jill Halpern. I'm a third-year student at Harvard Law. My question is addressed to Father Drynan. I think the panelists generally agree that right now, the way the abortion laws stand in the books, it results in practice and in discrimination between the rich and the poor, or rather the middle class and the poor. Now, my question is, if all abortion laws were eliminated, I think that there would still be that same discrimination between rich and poor, because the poor are known to take a far lesser advantage of medical facilities than the middle class. Would you oppose, if abortion laws were eliminated, would you oppose government programs attempting to narrow the attitudinal gap between rich and poor by supplying information to the middle to the poor about the availability of abortion?
All right, let me say first that the model penal code would certainly intensify the disparity between those who can get them and those who can't, because the wealthy woman of the upper middle class can always get good doctors and she can get an abortion. So that would certainly discriminate against the poor. Now, I mentioned that I have a greatest fear that abortion would become the birth control of the poor, and that poor people, poorly educated, who are unwilling or unable to use family planning information and techniques, that they would become pregnant the fifth, the sixth, the seventh time. Should society have a quasi-coercion suggesting that abortion is the indicated remedy? It seems to me that if there's one freedom, it's the freedom to have children, even if we say that this is irresponsible. And I'm very afraid that abortion will become the birth control of the poor. And under the social clause in the English law that was just passed, I think that's clearly predictable, that it was intended for that, and it will become that.
Well, I think that I don't see it as coercing, as changing the freedom of the poor to have children, but as changing the freedom of the poor to continue to be poor, which I don't think is a very valuable freedom. But I think that that you're misusing the word coercion when you say...
I said quasi-coercion.
Quasi-coercion. I'm proposing that if the facts were made available to the middle class and the poor on an equal basis, they would be enabled to make their own decisions in a way they can't really make now, because they don't have the same available information on birth control or on abortion.
Yeah, except the paradox there is that who are the people now getting illegal abortions? It's not the poor who don't have contraceptives available to them. It's the middle class and the upper class who can buy contraceptives and all types of things, who, like, just forget. And so, the availability doesn't mean that people are going to be wise and use these things.
That's true, but we've never made the information available sufficiently to the poor to see it.
All right, I advocated here that we all would say that public information, family counseling, all this type of thing should be available, tax support.
You
I said
not
that.
Feel that there was any duty on Catholics to oppose that.
Oh, no. We crossed that bridge years ago. Please, get with it.
This is the last question now. Well, wait a second. Mr. Blumenthal would like to comment.
There's just one thing that Father Drynan said which bothers me, and that is that, number one, in England, with the National Medical Health Program, I hardly believe that abortion is for the poor. In America, in New York, I've been accused of sponsoring Abortacade as an addition to Medicaid. Again, I must believe the physicians who have told me that it is not the poor who would suffer if, particularly in light of Medicaid services available in New York City hospitals, it would be those above the poor in terms of economic levels who don't quite make it to the upper middle class. I think, Father Drinan, you do an injustice when you talk about those who get pregnant by mistake. I don't think that's the people we're talking about all the time. I think the woman who wanted to have a baby and got German measles didn't get pregnant by mistake. She wanted to be pregnant. She maybe got sick by mistake, but I don't think we punish sick people.
Frank Kramer, first-year law student. It seems to me that part of Mr. Blumenthal's espousal of roughly the Model Penal Code's provisions is because while he feels that maybe the law should entirely withdraw from this field, the most he can do at this time is get across something of the nature of the bill he sponsored, and that this type of bill will have an educational value and perhaps allow for the law later entirely withdrawing from the field. Now, my question is to Father Drinan. Don't you think that this educational value and this possibility of some revamping the law should be allowed, as opposed to what seems to me you're posing an impossible alternative, either keeping the present laws or going entirely all the way at once and withdrawing from the field?
I don't think that it's educational, except that it educates in the wrong motives for things. It educates that a woman, for strictly selfish reasons, really, can say that I don't want this child. And it also states that we don't want undesirable children who may not be bright and beautiful. So it seems to me it's not educational. It's educational in all the wrong values, values to which I am very, very opposed. And I would much prefer the withdrawal. And I don't care about the political feasibility. That's somebody else's problem. And that I say that I you know, speak about moral issues, and that if we're going to be honest about this whole thing, and if we really want to help these individuals, and if we say that the law can't control and can't impede and can't, then let's say that, all right, if it's not politically feasible, I'll oppose the Model Penal Code, particularly the eugenic features, and I'll speak against it. And I will say that's a very disastrous thing of a utilitarian and pragmatic nature to allow into the law. And that I'm not going to have the parade of the horribles and say that this is can lead to all types of things. But I think that the moment that you say that a class of people, because they are defective or infirm, can be wiped out, that is a very basic compromise with everything that we believe in.
If I can just restate the position and get out of here, I guess. What you're saying is that even though without this sort of just making the public tolerant, aware, and allowing abortion somewhat, if we can't get to the withdrawal without this step, then we shouldn't have this middle step at all. Isn't that right?
Well, I spoke very... I don't care about rape or incest, and Mr. Blumenthal said there's less than 100 cases a year, and that's out of the hat, too. I've got it. There's 10 or 20 cases in the whole state of New York each year of rape. Pass that. Pass incest. I have no problem with that.
The point is that you can't...
But why do we have to couple these three things? Do they want three things or nothing? I'm willing to concede the second. I said that publicly. I've written that thing. Why must they couple these three things? I fought that in the Model Penal Code and the American Law Institute. Why must these three things? They're all unrelated. Totally unrelated.
Yeah, but if you can't get to the withdrawal...
Well, I don't care what they can
get. It's not your problem. Then you're in a specious position because you... If you can't go all the way, you've got to go part of the way.
Listen, it's not my problem in the New York legislature. I say these three things are totally unrelated to each other and totally different and proceed from different, totally different premises. So let them argue each one and let them fight each one, but don't package and say take this whole thing or nothing. I refuse to do that.
Gentlemen, on that note of refusal, I think we should end the forum for tonight.
Okay.